Bad patient. Malpractice makes perfect. I'm Robin Donovan.
And I'm Laura Marker.
And we are two non-medical, non-experts sifting through this week's health news.
And this week's words are CRISPR baby, five habits, life expectancies, and measles.
CRISPR baby sounds like a terrible snag. Laura, before we get started, I have a crab update for you.
Yes.
Okay. Here's what I learned about crabs last week. One, when someone brings you crab, sometimes they cook it first. So although you think you're getting a live bucket of scrabbly creatures, you could actually be getting a very docile plastic bag full of steamed crab, which is a little easier to handle when you have a bike class to get to. And I also learned that there's different species of crab that live in different oceans. So my friend had asked me how many crab I wanted, and I was thinking, like, okay, I want, like, one meal worth of crab. So I said, like, two or three if they're small. And I think they were kind of, like, split into halves. But anyway, I got, like, way more than, it was probably 2.5 meals or so worth of crab, which was lovely. But what was strange was that, like, the crab was so much bigger than I thought. And I was like, oh, this is like a whole different, like, I was picturing these little teeny guys that we used to catch when I was a kid in the Atlantic. And these were like big muscle crabs. Like, these crabs were like, they were big, right? Like 1.5 crabs would be like a whole meal. And when you're in the Carolinas eating crab, like, you, I don't know, I want to say, like, you get a bunch because they're little guys. So, and they tasted different, mm-hmm. like the different meat was a little different. Anyways, I don't want to gross out any listeners, but crab species, different out here. So, also, you want to know some health information about eating seafood?
Yes.
So, you really need omega-3 fatty acids, and although the recommended daily, I think they're calling it recommended daily allowance now. It used to be RDI, now it's RDA, or maybe vice versa, I don't remember. But anyway, so you really need this, like, omega-3 fatty acids, and it's hard to get enough of them in your diet. And so one really good way of doing that, according to dietitians who I have consulted with, is to eat 2 servings of fish a week. So I think crab counts. So if you're not eating any fish, you might want to think about looking at the amount of omega-3 stuff in your diet and checking out what we know so far to see if maybe you need some. And then you should look at heavy metals, because if you eat like salmon and swordfish and like bigger fishes, predator fishes, they can have more heavy metals and you want less heavy metals. So it's better to eat smaller fishes like, you know, sardines, anchovies, whatnot. So those are all my thoughts about fishes, Laura.
I like all your fishy thoughts.
Yeah. So can you tell me what's going on in the world this week so that I can have good podcast comments today?
So I was thinking about the fires in California right now. So they have...
Wait, time out. Are they still going?
No. So there was some rain over the past weekend that helped contain some of the fires. So they're now contained. I don't know if they're technically out or what, but like people who live in Paradise are still not allowed in Paradise as of like earlier that I heard, because like there's the possibility of like mudslides and like trees are dangerous and like different things and things. So I was just thinking about like the people who are displaced or have mm-hmm. still have missing loved ones who like the trauma of that and like trying to accommodate those people when there's like a spike in like a natural disaster or like something like that. And also that they're introducing in the firefighters like camps was like a counselor, because this fire had homes that were destroyed and like people were killed. And so like trying to help relieve the stress of the firefighters who are now going from one extreme event to another without as much of a break.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They are going for longer seasons, like fire season is now longer than it used to be, and they're more extreme events than there used to be, and so like trying to help with trauma that could be caused for that, and like the things that you see on the front lines and different things like that. So I was just thinking of like all the trauma informed care that needs to be happening in California because of these forest fires. That's what I was thinking of.
And like first responders or like people who are going house to house, like looking for human remains, which is a volunteer task these days. I mean, in a lot of ways, that sounds to me like a setup for post-traumatic stress, which is something that I think is really hard to deal with once you've been exposed to things. So it's weird because I feel like we're not there in terms of discussing mental health. And yet there's so many things happening now that make it seem really critical that we do more mental health care, you know, like all the shootings and all the fires and just like all the climate weirdness and, you know, violence in schools. It just, it's like, we're still not talking about it, but I feel like we're starting to reach a point where if you throw a rock, you can hit someone with post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just like looking at that and the mental health needs of our changing society and being more aware of that and trying to provide that support for people.
Or just trying to provide care.
In a timely fashion.
Yeah.
And
in a trauma-informed
find those
way.
People.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I heard... Did you say finding those people?
Yeah. So, like, just because they're impacted, like, doesn't mean, like, so they'll disperse, right, over time. Like, people won't move back to paradise.
Right.
Because they've lost everything. It's too... And it's too...
It's too traumatic.
It's too painful. They, you know, it's too traumatic. And so that community will spread out and around.
Yeah. It's like the 9/11 survivors. They're not all necessarily in New York anymore. I bet a lot of them aren't.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then, you know, people who are touched by other people who were, you know, directly impacted and that ripple effect. So
Some days I think every day everyone needs therapy. And some days I know that everyone needs therapy, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Are you ready for our first news story?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. So our first news story comes from Futurism. It's those CRISPR baby experiments were just banned by the Chinese government. Did you hear about the CRISPR babies?
Oh, yeah. That dude is in trouble. He's in trouble. Yeah. And there's an American doctor too, right? Involved?
I believe so. The Chinese Vice Minister of Science and Technology declared the research was illegal, immoral, and unethical.
And, like, that's China. They don't always... I want to say sometimes I might expect them to be more permissive than the U.S.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why they went to China is because what they were doing wasn't permitted in the United States. So that's a thing. So earlier this week, a Chinese researcher, Jiang Kuhi, had his work with a former graduate advisor, Michael Zhem, that they had altered the genomes of a viable human embryo using CRISPR, and the goal was to take out the gene that linked to HIV infection in the hopes to reduce, in hopes of creating resistance to that disease. And then the embryo was provided by married couples, and one of them had HIV and the other did not, and then were fertilized, and allegedly the result in the birth of two twin girls, which is interesting because China has a one-child policy, but it's fine.
Well, I mean, I think at that point you're breaking so many rules that you're like, oh, you're like, and by the way, there's two of them, you know?
Yeah. So China has deemed that that they can't do that. So, but there was a lot of discussion about CRISPR babies and the idea of, you know, designer babies, and it just made me think of that like 1990s movie Gattaca. Did you ever watch that?
I don't think so, but I've heard of it.
It's like a science fiction film that it takes place in like the distant future where people used eugenics to create the best possible child. And so there's essentially a divide with society of like designer babies and those who are not. And the main character is not a designer baby and ends up essentially impersonating a designer baby because he's just as smart and just as good or whatever. But he's kind of like But in this world, I think they've, like, moved. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I think it's, like, they've moved to, like, if you're not a designer baby, then you don't have access, or you can't go up to the upper echelons. You can't be as smart because you weren't a designer baby.
So. It's like being in the 1% in a brand new way. You know, like, it used to just be financial or cultural. Like, you can be a part of this, like, rich society if you have all this money or whatever. And now it could be, yeah, because you're going to be smarter. You're going to be better looking. You're going to get all those advantages, because those are all measurable advantages, right? Someone recently told me that men have a measurable increase in income for every inch of height within a certain range, that they just like, independent of their education or experience, they simply make more money, which is kind of the same as the research showing that people who are overweight tend to make less, or just people who are considered more objectively attractive in terms of handsomeness make more money. So there's all that, which is like such a, which is like such a conundrum, right? Because like, sometimes the scientific part of my brain is like, okay, if people who look better make more money, then I should figure out what's like scientifically considered most attractive on my face and like do that to my face. Like, I should wear makeup or something. But then I think, I mean, obviously that's like such an inauthentic way of existing. But, you know, like, I've had those moments, and maybe you have too, where you just think, I don't know. I mean, if, what if it, what if all it took for me to make 3% more was like a little mascara? And then I'm just like, well, I guess part of me is like also in denial, you know, that I'm like, come on, I'm so great. No, like, my skills will come to the fore. Like, I don't know. Have you ever thought about that?
No, but now I do.
Well, this was like, I was reading this blogger, Penelope Trunk, who's like a career blogger, and she became controversial a few years ago for live tweeting a miscarriage. But she talks a lot about, she has what used to be considered Asperger's. I don't know if she's calling it autism now, but of course we've now folded Asperger's into the autism spectrum. So she's kind of a different type of thinker, and she often, I would read her posts because it would just be career advice that would be kind of against the grain. And she'd have a lot of information about like millennials and women in the workplace. And she did this whole thing, this whole article once on how plastic surgery is going to become really commonplace when people realize that looking better can equal making more money. And she's like, it's not going to be big, crazy stuff. It's going to be like fillers and just like things that kind of slow down the appearance of your aging. And I was like super horrified by that. Or like, maybe I'm just happy that that's not yet a big thing. I feel like by the time we're 50, that'll be like a young person thing or something. Maybe. I don't know. I'm just glad. I'm glad I don't have to do it. Or I don't feel like I have to. So what do you see as like the biggest problem with like CRISPR babies?
Well, like, it's unregulated, and it's Pandora's box. Like, that's what this article says. Because like, it's a slippery slope, you know, like, of what you deem like acceptable. I mean, so like, if you could genetically modify deafness out of the genes, like, for a lot of people within the deaf community, being deaf is not viewed as a disability. It is a part of their identity, and they have a very strong culture. So like, what one person determines positive might not necessarily be, or a negative might not necessarily be like a negative for everybody. And so, you know, it's that choice of, do you modify things, or do you try to, you know, get rid of a particular trait or whatever? And that just seems like it could be a dangerous thing. Also, I don't want to have to be a lesser person because I'm not a genetically modified baby.
Well,
so
I think it's too late for us. I guess it's also the uncertainty of what will happen. Like, we don't know the exact health outcomes of modifying. Like, I think there are parts of the genome that we may not know everything that they do. So if we change them, I suppose there's like the fear that we don't know what will happen. And it's like human testing, right? Like, these babies never consented to be modified. And there's like, there's no way to get the consent of an unborn child. So there's like no way that would currently be considered ethical of testing this. But yet, like, this guy is pointing out, well, what if we could, you know, prevent a disease like AIDS? Although, to be fair, I don't know if AIDS is the first one I would go for, that we've made so much progress. I think if I was that guy, I would go for a mutation that would be more deadly, you know? But I guess...
Yeah.
He probably had to he probably had to find people willing to do this. And if you have a gene mutation you might pass on that's potentially deadly, maybe you're not willing to have your kids be part of an experiment. Whereas, like, the HIV people... I think the transmission rate is actually, like, much lower than you would think. Like, even if the mom is HIV positive, the kid is not necessarily. That's a very interesting... Yeah, because I think people assume that, like, if one of the parents is, that the baby definitely will be, but that is not the case.
Yeah. I did read some earlier things about this because I was going to pick another article, and then I saw that he has been chastised by the Chinese government. Was that they haven't really been able to independently verify that this claim is true to a satisfactory level. So, I mean, it's brand new or whatever. So, but the science community wasn't fully believing that
the baby's team was able
to accomplish what they claimed, you know, it was that it worked the way that they said it had. So,
yeah, I mean, it is kind of like, I did this. I mean, like, how do we know? Okay, Laura, I looked this up. World Health Organization, mother to child transmission of HIV, says in the absence of any, because I don't know if you're still interested in this, but I am. In the absence of any intervention, transmission rates range from 15% to 45%. This rate can be reduced to below 5% with effective interventions during pregnancy, labor, delivery, and breastfeeding. So I think it's looking like they use antiretroviral drugs for the mom and for the infant for a shorter period. So it's basically like they have medications that can take the risk and, you know, and really reduce it. Yeah, because can you imagine, like, with there only being a 5% chance of transmission? I mean, that's high in the grand scheme of things. But given that the mom is HIV positive, I find that amazing. Right. I find that amazing.
Yeah, way to go, science.
I know, which is why I'm saying if we're going to be, like, doing human testing to eliminate illnesses, I'm not saying HIV/AIDS is not, like, important, but I'm saying I don't know if that's the one that would justify it because it's become almost like a chronic illness now for certain people. Although not people in developing countries, not people that don't have access to good medical care, and certainly it is life-altering. But you know what I mean? I want to say, like, do this –
It's not the death sentence it used to be.
Yeah. Find an illness that is a death sentence. And even then, Jesus.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on.
So our next article comes from the Washington Post, and it's Want to live a longer life? Researcher says you should do these five things. Oh, so Jesus. This is not talking about the latest craze, the newest fad. This is talking about five things that you can do objectively to live longer. According to a new study in Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, lays out five practices, none of which involve following a fad.
Is it sleeping and eating study, well? I want to guess them.
okay.
Sleeping a lot, eating well, exercising, based on the photo, not smoking, and like social connections are my guesses.
Close. You got, I think, three of the five. So the study appears in the American Heart Association journal Circulation, which analyzed data on more than 100,000 people who were followed for 34 years.
Woo.
And they looked at life expectancy among those who engaged in the five low risk lifestyle factors, such as not smoking.
Ding, 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 ding.
when they're practiced together, the five low risk lifestyle factors could increase lifespan quite significantly on an average of 14 years for women and 12 years for men.
I like it.
The five factors are avoiding smoking. Low risk is defined as never smoking.
Thanks.
Maintaining a healthy weight. And they recommend using body mass index as a quick and easy way to do that, although there are limitations to it. Mm-hmm. Exercise regularly, which means moderate to vigorous intensity of exercise for 30 or more minutes a day, consuming moderate amounts of alcohol, and maintain an overall healthy diet, which means high intakes of vegetables, fruits, nuts, whole grains, polyunsaturated fatty acids, and long chain omega-3 fatty acids.
Who just told you about omega-3s? Low intakes of
red and processed meat.
Boom. You did. You're welcome.
and sugar sweetened beverages, trans fats, and sodium. So part of it was that they followed such a large amount of it, and it looked at, you know, for such a long period of time. And then it kind of gives you some recommendations if you're, like, trying to do this, that not to just try to do all of them all at the same time, but to – and then it gives you a recommendation. So if you're kind of decrease your alcohol consumption is your focus, considering cutting out drinking at home. Or if social drinking is your main issue, set a goal for drinks per week and keep yourself accountable. Yeah. If you're trying to quote, research smoking cessation programs. If you're trying to improve your diet, start by adding one or more vegetable and fruit to your daily diet. And if exercise is your priority, add a 30-minute workout to your regimen to get towards your daily routine. And if you're trying to lose weight, consider reducing your caloric intake by 250 to 500 calories a day.
Yeah, I really like this article because it's giving tips that are based on research that shows how people successfully make changes. Like, we know that if you want to lose weight, that slow weight loss over a longer period of time is more likely to be sustainable, and that small stepwise changes are better than a cold turkey type of situation. And so I was super impressed, and I scrolled down to the bottom because I was like, who is this person? And it turns out that the article is written by a registered dietitian. So that is maybe why we are getting such good data here. Because, you know, I was like, wow, this is like pretty good tips for a journalist who's not citing anything. How did they get this information? And then I was like, oh, it's a dietitian. Also, fun fact, do you know the difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist?
No.
Well, I don't either, but I know this. A dietitian has more You're welcome. A dietitian has more training, and it's like an official licensure, like, whereas anyone can say that they're a nutritionist, as far as I understand it. So if you're getting nutrition advice, ideally you'd want to get it from someone who is, like, in the US, a registered dietitian. Because, like, I tomorrow could say, like, I'm a nutritionist, like, I'm a nutritional expert. And that doesn't necessarily mean anything. So thank you to my dietitian friend who tells me about these things all the time. Thanks, Christopher. You're awesome. But so there you go. I'm very also happy that the omega-3 acids came in, fatty acids came in, because, you know, I try.
Closing the loop.
Yeah. This also reminds me of that story we did last week with the, or was it 2 weeks ago, with the drinking thing, or the the UK, like, public health campaign to get everyone to drink less. Man, the limit is so low. I don't think, especially women, I don't think realize that when they're saying, like, alcohol can be okay for women, it's one drink maximum. And this, like, this article says 1/2 to 1 drink per day, which is what? 6 ounces of beer, and not like this new beer that's 13% alcohol by volume. You know, one shot, a small glass of wine. I think part of the problem of putting these alcohol practices into play is that, like, beer and wine are so high alcohol now that it's almost like drinking like dilute liquor in some cases, like, in terms of alcohol content. So it's like, how do you get someone to be like, oh, I can have a quarter of a glass of wine because it's a high alcohol wine? Like, no one wants to drink two sips of wine, or, like, no one wants to pay $12 for a glass of wine at a restaurant and then, like, just stare at it and sniff it for the rest of the night. I don't know. I don't know why I care about the alcohol thing so much, but I just feel like there's like conflicting information about alcohol, but even the information that tells us that some alcohol might be okay is poorly understood. Like, I think honestly, people think that a glass or two of wine a night, a few nights a week, is generally good. And I think that is kind of a misinterpretation of this data, right? Like, if you're a woman and you're drinking 2 glasses of wine 3 nights a week, that's more. That's into, like, the danger zone per all this research. And maybe you don't care and that's fine, but, you know. When people are like, I'm doing it for my health, I'm like, dump out half that wine then. Like, cut back, people. Cut back. Well, these are pretty good.
Okay.
I'm a little worried that the next story is going to be super irritating, because that one made me so happy.
Hey, you ready for
Hey, you ready for the next article?
Ready to go.
All right. So the next one comes from Yahoo News. Yeah. And it's USA Life expectancy drops again as overdoses climb. So the CDC puts out a report every year, and it showed that life expectancies in the United States dropped yet again as overdose continued to climb, with more than 70,000 lives in 2017, and suicides rose by 3.7%. Overdoses rose 9.6% compared to 2016. Wow. As a result, the average lifespan of an American has dropped to 78.6 years, a decrease of 0.1 year from 2016. However, it is a trend in since 2014. Americans have lost 0.3 years of life. Haven't been, declines like this haven't been seen since the Great Flu pandemic in 1918 and World War One.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Although the losses were steeper then, the peak of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the 1980s also saw a nationwide drop in life expectancy.
Yep.
Canadians live on average 3 years longer than Americans. Japan.
Okay.
Has the longest life expectancy in the world at almost 84. So drug overdoses, deaths from synthetic opioids like fentanyl, have increased by 45% between 2016 and 2017. The rate of heroin deaths is seven times higher than 1999.
Hmm.
And it appears that most of the deaths were unintentional.
Yeah. And I think we should clarify that they're talking about heroin because some people who start to use opioids ultimately switch to heroin. I think it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. It is.
I thought you were going to say didn't know. But you do know.
I do know. I think I know. So Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania are the top three states that have opioids deaths in 2017, according to this report. And I live in Ohio. And the town that I live in has a definite heroin problem and an opioid addiction. Yeah. It's impacted a lot of people in where I live. So, and it's a nationwide. And I was listening to some other reports because it just came out. The opioid deaths are mostly east of the Mississippi, is primarily where they are found. So they're talking about like that kind of choices and stuff. And it's most of the deaths are being caused because of the fentanyl, which is like 25 times more powerful than heroin.
Yeah, I mean, these are drugs that were developed for like severe pain, cancer patients, people at end of life, like never intended to be a recreational thing, but here we are.
Yeah.
So I have an interest in leading causes of death just because I've known about them for a few years. Because
you're that person.
Okay, that's fair. I'm that much of a nerd. Okay, and the one thing that frustrates me about this data, like this, like, countrywide data that the CDC puts out, is that it's just not updated as often as I feel like it could be. So we still, the most recent one, sorry, did you hear that little beep? Because that was my alarm going off. Sometimes I take a nap at this time. I like to wake up at this time. All right, just so you know. So the leading causes of death in 2016. So I feel like 2017 should be available. It's almost 2019. Like, I don't understand. But okay, they probably have limited funding, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so heart disease is number one with 635,000 deaths and change. Then cancer, accidents, chronic lower respiratory diseases, stroke, Alzheimer's, diabetes, influenza, and pneumonia, which, hello, if only there were, I don't know, a flu shot, maybe you should get it. Okay, never mind. Nephritis, nephrotic syndrome, and nephrosis, which are kidney issues. And then suicide is the 10th. So what's interesting here, I think, is that, so I told you the top, the number for the heart disease, which was 635,000. The suicide deaths in 2016 were just under 45,000. And this article is telling us that 70,000 people died via drug overdose in 2017. So my question is, I wonder if the CDC, like, I wonder if drug overdose is not like the cause of death, you know? And if that's why it's not, because you'd think if it's that high in 2017, it would have it would have bumped out some of these other things in 2016, because there's like three leading causes of death in 2016 that were in the low 50,000. So I wonder if the CDC, if it's like, if overdose is classified some other way that makes it, you know, that makes it less trackable, because that doesn't make sense to me. Cause. Yeah. I know it's different years, but you would still think if it's 70,000 in 2017, how much was it in 2016? Well, they said it rose 10%, so that'd be somewhere in the 60s, mid-60,000s, right? So, yeah. So anyway, I'm not sure how the CDC is classifying it, but we could say it's fair to say that drug overdose is a leading cause of death in our country. Also, that we need to move to Canada and or Japan. I suggest Canada because Japan is quite far away, and I feel like taking a lot of, you know, cross or, you know, flights around the globe is going to lower my life expectancy because it's stressful and you get radiation from a plane. So, but maybe we could move to Canada. What do you think, Lara?
It is colder there, so
no. True. But seriously, Canadians live 3 years longer than us? That's a lot. Because we're saying in this article that a decline of life expectancy of 0.3 years was significant. Okay. Well, they live 3 years longer than us. 3 years. That's a lot of 0.3s. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're really, that's a lot. Oh.
Absolutely.
I also appreciate that the article points out that drug overdose was, like, involved in the death of Prince and Tom Petty. They were like, it's like, hey, dumb Americans, do we need a way to personalize this for you? Do you need to understand what this means for you? You could still have Prince. You could still have Tom Petty if we would have addressed this. Like, I don't know. I also am confused as to why they included tramadol, because tramadol is not an opioid medication as far as I know. So why is that in there? I mean, tramadol is like a painkiller, but my understanding is that a lot of times they prescribe that to avoid... Oh, nope. I'm so wrong. So wrong. Okay. I take it all back. Tramadol. It's a narcotic. Things that I learn from this podcast.
You're welcome.
Okay, there's this article on this website called drugabuse.com that says, is tramadol the new OxyContin? God knows. I had this idea in my head that tramadol is something that they sometimes prescribe when they don't want to give something more heavy duty, but I don't know. I don't really know why they prescribe certain opioids when they do. But that would be interesting to look into. Hint, hint. Laura.
Sounds like a Robin project.
It sounds like a Robin project for next week. Okay, I'll make a note. It sounds like something I'm going to Google whether or not we have this podcast. Thank God that we do.
Yes. All right. You ready for our last article? Okay. It comes from NBC News, and it's measles cases up 30% worldwide, WHO says. So the measles vaccine has saved 21 million lives since 2000, but more than 6.7 million people, mostly young children, caught measles in 2017. According to a WHO report, 110,000 died from the virus. That is down from about 500,000 deaths in 2000. But progress the world had been making towards eliminating measles through vaccine is quickly being reversed. This is in part due to the economic chaos in countries such as Venezuela, or conflict and unrest in countries like Pakistan and Nigeria. But in other countries, such as Italy, anti-vaccine sentiment means that more kids are going unvaccinated.
God, help us.
So we thought we were making headway on it, but we're slowing down. Global vaccination rates are just about 85% on average, with only 67% of the world population receiving the second needed dose of the MMR.
Which is
to stop the transmission
measles,
of
measles, mumps, rubella.
Measles, mumps, and rubella. Rubella. To stop the transmission of the highly contagious virus, 95% of the population needs to be vaccinated. So, and then it goes on to tell how very contagious measles is. 9 out of 10 people who are not vaccinated against measles will catch it if they are exposed to it. Measles is an airborne virus, so simply walking into a room with somebody else who has measles can expose people to the virus. If every single person gets measles, 12 to 18 others people get it, typically babies too young to be vaccinated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's what people don't understand. Like, that is a much different and much higher rate of contagion than with many illnesses that we are exposed to. Like, it is not the case. I should Google this. I'm fairly certain it's not the case with, like, a cold. Like, if you go into a room and you have a cold, 90% of those people are not going to get the cold. But that's like if you had a cold and you went to your office and you had a meeting in a conference room with 20 people and 18 of those people got the cold. That is what it would be like with measles if people are not vaccinated. You know what I mean? Like I just feel like people don't understand that. They don't understand how contagious it is. And the people who are going to get it, like they say, are old people, immunocompromised people, infants, and people that decided not to get vaccinated. But I mean, that's why like there are certain pediatricians who are choosing not to see unvaccinated children now, because like if you have a sick kid who can't be vaccinated, guess where you need to take them all the time? The doctor's office, you know, and stuff like that. It is deeply concerning.
Yeah. So there are 41,000 of cases in Europe mm-hmm. alone, making it the worst year in a decade for measles in Europe. There's with the different war and poverty makes it harder for some places to vaccinate. And then also the misinformation about vaccinations is causing people to choose not to vaccinate. And it ends with an author who wrote a book about the anti-vaccine saying, "This should be a wake-up call that the anti-vaccine movement is not a fringe movement. It is a well-organized public health destruction machine," which I thought was very strong.
But I don't know what you do. I mean, when kids are dying, it seems like, I think maybe what we need is some sort of ability for people who are concerned about vaccines to get more information or to see this data. Because I want to say, certainly there have been people who've had like an allergic reaction or something to a vaccine. So like just telling people like it's safe is not enough. People need to see exactly what the numbers are. But I have often wondered like what it would take, or, you know, because the information is out there. I just think we're kind of in a climate, you know, a culture of not trusting science as much now too, and maybe not understanding always how science works. And I don't know. I wish we could create like safe spaces for people to have doubts about vaccines and like put the information out there, you know, because sometimes I feel like there's people who are on the fence and they're not sure. They might be open to this stuff, but like they're only getting information from their friends who are like, it's bad, you can't trust it, it's big pharma, it's chemicals, it's toxic, like all these buzzwords. And I feel like if you could show them a chart to say like, here's the risk of driving your car, here's the risk of taking an aspirin, here's the risk of drinking a glass of water, or like chewing on a ballpoint pen cap, like that's a thing that kills like 10 people a year or something, right? And be like, here's the risk of getting the vaccine, you know? I feel like if you could somehow like show people the proportional risk, because there is like a minute risk associated with it, right? Like if you could show them the proportional risk, is this just wishful thinking? I have to think that like people are more reasonable than this.
Well, when you're not sure, you don't want to do something that could possibly hurt your child, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the reasoning. When you're not sure, they would rather just not.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an ethically fraught issue.
And that's why anti-vaccinators have done a very purposeful and deliberate attempt to create disinformation mm-hmm. to make people confused or not sure. And so they feel like the safer choice is just not to vaccinate, when in fact that can be leaving your child up to horribly deadly diseases. And also, like, people who survive measles can also become blind, mm-hmm. Can be left blind because of it. So,
yeah, and that's the other thing. I think, you know, it's not like, oh, you just get this disease and they're going to give you a little antibiotic and everything's going to be fine. Like, the reason we have these vaccines is because these were like virulent illnesses that were killing people. I think maybe virulent is the wrong word, or possibly I'm even pronouncing that, but you get the point. I've definitely read articles where they're saying that one of the things that we're going to experience as a society that we have not experienced is really horrific illness, like horrific contagious illness, because mm-hmm. we're so used to it not being a thing. Like, even Ebola, that's a thing for other parts of the world, right? Like, that's, we had like one case in the US or something, and we like locked it down, and the CDC and like the, you know, the government's making comments on it and all this stuff. Measles, you know, I mean, it's like the idea of taking pollution and dumping it somewhere else. It's like, taking toxic waste to China and pretending like la 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 la, like that's never going to get in our water supply. Like it's all connected. And I feel like just because there's certain illnesses that we can keep out of the U.S., that some of this stuff is so contagious. Like all it takes is more and more people not to vaccinate, and then there's going to be a bunch of kids who die. Yeah. Like, okay, all right, I think I need to move on. I think I'm good here. Done. Finished.
So what is your current medical fascination?
Well, my first fascination is I'd like to put in a strong request for no more vaccines. Like next week, no vaccine stories. I can't do it. It's freaking me out. I just need people to vaccinate. But like no one's going to change their mind. So why are we even talking about it? And we keep talking about it. It's very anxiety provoking. Okay, so there's that. My actual...
No, we talk about it because it's part of the world in health news. And we talk about it because there's misinformation about vaccines. Yeah. And by combating that misinformation is by correcting the story.
We talk about it because that's you're a better person than me, Robin. Essentially. So I'm like, this is all very stressful. This is all very stressful. Can everyone please just go home, turn off the podcast, Google herd immunity, you know, and then just start there. Just start there. Yeah. So anyway, my current health fascination this week has been nutrient timing, which is like a sports nutrition concept that's become very trendy. And it's this idea that we used to kind of think like, if you want to be big and strong, you got to eat a lot of protein, and you know, or whatever, that you had to eat certain ratios of things. Now we're starting to think that what you eat, the timing, what you eat around a workout could influence the way that your muscles are able to be built and the way that your body is going to store glycogen for future workouts or whatever you're doing in your life. So there's like, it's not, I would say this is not yet really like confirmed by science, but there's this idea that there is like a, some people say 30 minute, some people say 60 minute type of metabolic window where you want to eat carbohydrate and protein, and that is supposed to help with increasing your muscle mass. So actually there is some information on that. I think we don't know like exactly when it closes, but eating protein and carbs right after a workout, like the dietitians, you know, the licensed ones, they found that that is the thing. But then there also becomes like this whole thing about what about timing your nutrients throughout the day for superior performance. So I've been talking a lot about this Purple Patch podcast lately, and they had a episode a few months ago that was kind of like recommending that in the morning for like endurance athletes, that in the morning you focus on eating more carbohydrate type of meals, and then as the day goes on, you're moving toward more protein and fat types of meals. So actually, if you're going to eat a dessert, it'd be better to eat it, they're saying, at breakfast. And this may also be based on exercising in the morning. I haven't figured that out. And then in the evening, you kind of want to eat more of like your meat and your vegetables. So if you like went to a steakhouse, as was their example, you'd want to eat like the steak and the salad and the green beans, but maybe not the potato in the evening. So I find that very interesting, this idea of like, you know, how your body can work around these things. Because the other thing that's true is that the macronutrients that you take in can be converted to what your body needs. It just takes a little more energy, so it's not quite as efficient. So if you eat like only protein and your body needs some kind of carbohydrate, like things can be, your body can get what it needs to a certain extent. People don't just like only eat one thing, but that's not as efficient. And so, yeah. So I've been kind of experimenting a little bit with trying to do, mostly what I've been doing is like not doing fat in the morning and doing more fat in the evening. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't even know how I would measure this, but I just was like, well, let me just see what happens, like see if anything happens. And so I've been like really curious if that's really a thing or not. But of course, like as with so many things, our appetite for information outstrips the amount of research that we have done. So we know that, yeah, within an hour of a workout, you should consume some amount of protein and carbohydrate, whatever. But as far as like all this other stuff, it's kind of a question mark. So I've been curious about that. So have you been thinking about your nutrient timing, Laura? Have you been thinking about my nutrient timing? Because I've been thinking about it. You know what the biggest problem?
Well, I'm glad somebody's thinking about it.
The biggest problem I'm having with it was I was always a banana and peanut butter person in the morning. And now I'm like, well, I can have my banana and I can have my peanut butter. But if the morning is low fat and the evening is low carb, there's never a good time to have a banana with peanut butter. And that may be the straw that breaks the camel's back here. I mean, maybe at lunch? I don't know. They didn't spell it out. Like, I'm not really sure exactly how it's supposed to work. All I know is I don't know how much I like a banana without peanut butter. It's so much worse. So, all right. I think that's enough bad patienting for me for one day. Laura, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, I think you've covered everything.
Do you eat peanut butter on your bananas?
No.
Okay, well, that could explain why we're getting so many cranky vaccination stories. Folks, thanks for listening. If you're enjoying the podcast, please rate, share, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your media. You can visit us on Twitter at The Bad Patient, online at thebadpatient.com. You can email us story ideas or topics you'd like us to cover at hello@thebadpatient.com. And before we take off, we want to say a special thank you to our theme song composer, Evan Schaefer. His music is available at SoundCloud.
Thanks, Evan.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. SoundCloud.com/Evan Schaefer. Until next time, we are Bad Patient.
Malpractice makes perfect.